Chapter 41. Symington heard the echo of gunfire from her position on the high terrace of the house. She called to two support unit cops and rushed through the ballroom where the Shannon family were already beginning to gather for safety. She spoke briefly to Inspector Aitchison, whom she left to guard the family alongside one of his men and two of the Shannon's own security detail.
"Symington to DS, Scott. Who discharged the weapon? Over."
There was no response, as she hurried toward the large spiral stairwell. Because of the loss of power, the lift wasn't operational, but emergency lights had been installed along the corridors and on the stairs, so the way ahead was clear, if somewhat dim. Soon she and her little party of officers were on the ground floor of the mansion.
"Which way?"
she yelled, as one of the support unit cops took the lead. Having carefully studied the layout of the house, he knew the quickest way to the location Scott had last called in.
"Open it, Constable,"
commanded Symington, as they reached an old fire door. The officer strained at the release bar, and eventually the double doors burst open, a rush of cold air hitting the police officers like a wall. She raced out onto a set of shallow steps. In the moonlight she saw a man lying in the snow, a group of people looking on.
"What's happening?"
she shouted to Daly, who had his handgun pointed at two men standing with their hands on their heads. She instantly recognized Maxwell.
"Ma'am, this man aimed a weapon at D.S. Scott. They backed down after a warning."
"This is outrageous,"
spat Maxwell.
"Your chief constable will hear of this as soon as I can raise him."
"Why did you allow him to remove the safety catch of the weapon and aim the pistol at my officer's head?" asked Daly.
"It all happened in a fraction of a second. We thought we were under attack."
"My ass," shouted Scott. "We spotted you lurking about the house.
What was that, eh?"
"A security check, nothing more." "I wish you had just left this to me and my men," said Maxwell. "The police have been worse than useless since they arrived."
As one constable helped Scott to his feet, and another tended to his young colleague, still reeling from the blow he had taken to the head, Daly, Symington, and Dunn examined the security worker. He'd been hit in the arm by Daly's shot and was groaning in pain.
"You'll live," said Symington. "But we'll need to get you some first aid up in the house. Help me up with him, please, DCI Daly."
"Stop! Everyone just stay where you are."
The Cockney accent of Maxwell's head of security was unmistakable. He stood a few feet away on the path, a machine gun pointed at the group.
"Put the bloody gun down, Barry," said Maxwell. "One of these police officers is likely to blow your fucking head off."
"Can't oblige, I'm afraid, Mr. S,"
he replied, grinning at his boss.
"Nev, collect the shooters."
Another Shannon security man walked over to the nearest of the support unit cops.
"Give it here, mate,"
he said, taking possession of the constable's automatic rifle.
"Right, now the rest,"
shouted Barry, as he was joined by two other members of the private security detail, all with drawn weapons.
"What in hell's name do you think you're doing, Barry?"
said Maxwell, walking towards his head of security.
"That's far enough, Mr. S. We wouldn't want you to get one in the head now, would we?"
Daly groaned as he was frisked and his handgun taken from him.
"Fucking brilliant, Maxwell," said Scott. "Good to see you've got guys you can trust."
"I like you, Mr. Scott, so I won't blow your fucking brains out," said Barry, walking over to the group of police officers. "And just to make sure you all behave, I'll be having this pretty thing."
He grabbed Dunn by the hair and pulled her towards him.
"Get your hands off her,"
shouted Daly, taking a stride towards Dunn and her captor, his fists clenched. Barry pulled back Dunn's head and held his machine gun at her throat.
"Come on, DCI Daly. Wouldn't it be a pity to slot this little piece of tail? I think you've been doing a bit of that already,"
he smiled as his men began to laugh.
"I've got to say, I thought this would have been much more difficult. Don't make policemen like they used to, that's for sure. Not up here in Jocko Land, anyway."
21, code 21.
Symington, who was standing out of sight behind Daly, spoke quickly into her radio. She was about to say more when she was pistol-whipped by Barry, knocking her to the ground.
"That wasn't very clever now, was it?"
he said, his firearm thrust back into Dunn's neck.
"The only reason I don't off this girl right now is that I've taken a bit of a fancy for her. It's going to be a long, cold night, and I'll need a bit of warming up."
"My inspector will have heard that call. You forget, we're not the only police officers here,"
said Symington, rolling onto her hands and knees and spitting blood into the snow.
"Let's see about that. Nev, give the lads a shout, would you? Everything's secured in the ballroom, over, said Nev into his radio. All good up here. Cops disarmed and subdued. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't mind, let's get you out of the cold. There's someone coming to see you all.
He dragged Dunn by the hair, making her cry out as they and the rest of the group, under the watchful eyes of the armed security guards, made their way back across the snow into Cursive House. Moore looked at his wife, lying pale and lifeless in the improvised mortuary in the bland district nurse's garage. The nurse looked on, wringing her hands in concern.
"I'm sorry you have to see her like this, Reverend Moore. It's all we could do, what with the snow and all. Once the road's clear, we'll get her to the undertaker in Kinloch."
"What? Ah, yes," said Moore. "I'm obliged to you, Mrs. Peary. I know you've done your best. She's at rest now."
"Yes, indeed. I can't believe this has happened."
"Nor me, Lena. Nor me."
He stroked a loose strand of hair from his wife's forehead.
"Who did this? I mean, who fired the shot that killed her?"
"Oh, I don't know for sure, Reverend Moore. I heard the police officers talking when they brought her in. I think it was the detective sergeant, the one who was caught up on the bonfire."
Moore sighed.
"Yeah, I know who he is. Could you give me a moment?"
"Certainly. Just come through when you're ready."
She padded off, leaving Moore alone.
"I don't know what you were doing. I don't even know who you really are. It seems we were on opposite sides, but I'm not even sure of that. But I promise you, I'll pay back those that killed you. That bloody family has had a good go at ruining my life, and now they've ended yours. Revenge is all there's left."
He kissed the cold forehead of his wife and left the garage. Chapter 42. There was a gasp of dismay when the police officers, along with Maxwell, were led into the ballroom at Cursive House, hands on heads. Superintendent Symington staggered, a livid bruise already blooming on her face where she had been hit with the pistol. Daly was pale and exhausted, still recovering from his ordeal at the Rat Stone. He blinked in the bright light of the ballroom, one of the few areas of the main house supplied with energy from the generators. The room was filled with the Shannon family and their staff, including some villagers who had been hired to attend to the party during their time in the house. A young woman sobbed as she watched the policeman being marched forwards.
"Right, people," said Barry. "I want you cops where we can keep an eye on you. Sit there."
He pointed to the middle of the long boardroom table.
"Make yourselves comfortable while I get acquainted with Mary here. That's your name, isn't it, darling?"
"Wait," said Symington, her voice weak but determined. "If any harm comes to my officers, you will be brought to justice, I promise you that. The road to Kinloch will be clear soon, and my officers will be here shortly, not to mention our colleagues from Glasgow. They won't take kindly to one of their own being harmed. Whatever you intend to do, give it up before things get serious."
"Things are just about as serious as they can get. Just relax. After all, it's the start of a new year. The last one for most of you, I shouldn't wonder."
He laughed as he dragged the struggling Dunn from the room.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Daly, I really am," said Ailsa, sitting in her usual place at the head of the table.
She appeared calm, though tired, with large shadows under her eyes.
"Superintendent, are you all right? I demand that somebody attends to this woman."
She looked around the room at the security guards, who were now holding the family hostage, rather than protecting them.
"Yes, do as my aunt says," shouted Maxwell. "You men still have a chance to get yourselves out of this. We'll make you all rich if you let us go and help us out of here, I promise."
But his words were cut short by a blow to the head. He cowered into his chair, hands over his head for protection. Bruce spoke up.
"Okay, guys, take it easy. We're all here for a reason, so let's not get carried away. You're not going to massacre us, so what's the deal, eh?"
He was holding his daughter Nadia close, and felt her flinch as Nev barked a reply.
"You're very confident. I'm not sure I would be if I were you. Now shut up, the lot of you," he shouted.
As the room hushed, the large doors burst open, and a cloaked figure stepped into the crowded ballroom. Jock Munro was standing in one of the mansion's long corridors, debating what to do. Despite his assurances to the contrary, he'd followed Symington out of the building and watched from the shadows as she and her team were taken prisoner by the Shannon security detail. He decided that he really had only one option, to try and get to the village and seek help. He'd counted 10 security men so far, but there were plenty of stout farmers in Blan with access to guns. He was about to search for a quiet route out of the house when he heard voices.
"Nah, don't be shy. I tell you what, you play the game, and I'll make sure you get out of this little mess alive."
Jock peered around the corner. The brawny security guard he'd seen earlier had unzipped Dunn's ski jacket and was pushing her up against a wall, groping her through her thick jersey as she struggled to get free.
"Come on, what's a little ride? Or would you prefer some of this?" he said, forcing her to her knees with one hand while unbuttoning his trousers with the other. "No biting now."
He held her nose with his large hand so that she was forced to gulp air in through her open mouth. He laughed as Dunn squirmed.
"Leave me alone, you bastard," she said,
then screamed as he caught her by her auburn hair and forced her head back. Suddenly she felt his body go limp. He slumped forwards and slid down the wall. Dunn fought to push him off her and onto the floor. She was shocked to see Jock in the corridor, the machine gun Barry had left on the floor, clasped in his big hands.
"You'd better take charge of this," he whispered. "I hate the bloody things. We have to get out of the house and down to the village to get help. There are 10 security guards. Well, 9 now," he continued, looking at the limp figure on the floor. "We have to be quick."
"Is he dead?" said Dunn.
"I gave him a fair dunt on the head, I must admit. Come on, lassie. This one's mates will come looking for him soon."
He pointed down the dim corridor to a back stairwell.
"We'll get down to the ground floor this way, but then we'll have to work out how to get out of this bloody place."
Dunn took the lead, the gun slung over her shoulder, as they made their way down the narrow staircase. They were on the last flight of stairs when someone called out from the floor below.
"Stay exactly where you are, and put the gun down."
"Bastard," said Jock.
Moore stood at the bottom of the long driveway that led up to Cursive House. The moon's eerie light was diffused through the clouds, lending a weak luminescence to the snow. He looked around, making sure he was alone. As he stared into the bay, a large object appeared from behind the long promontory where once the castle had stood. Even in the strange light, it was clearly a vessel, long and sleek. Moore ducked into the shadows as he took his first step on the driveway towards the house. Though the road had been kept relatively clear of snow, he chose to plough his way through the accumulations on the verge. Here he could stay out of sight as he climbed the winding path to the mansion. He knew that the death of his young wife should have been his driving force, but it wasn't. She had been part of something he didn't understand. With every step, he felt the pain of the belt as it hit his back and legs, the kicks of his stomach and punches in the face. The brass plaque, property of Shannon Agricultural Australia Limited, shone out at him from the bureau. He had been as much of a possession as the old piece of furniture. The plan to wrest control of the company from the Shannons had excited him. It was all he had worked towards for years. Install Maxwell as boss, force him to transfer funds into his associates' bank accounts, then leave him to take the fall as his company disintegrated. He'd told himself, prayed, that he was doing the right thing. Now he was sure of it. He turned to face the sea. The large ship was motionless now, about a mile out in the bay. Someone had come to Blan to see the Shannons. But why? He couldn't wait to find out. He hurried on through the deep snow. Daly had an ache in his heart as he watched the figure under the hooded cloak. By size, shape, and demeanour, it was obviously a man. He recalled the shock of seeing Veronica sitting on the log in similar attire, casually smoking a cigarette. The robed man said nothing, nor did he move. Suddenly the huge screen at the end of the ballroom began to unroll across nearly the whole length of the wall. There were choked sobs as those in the room tried to muffle their fear, not wanting to draw the attention of the guards. Everyone looked scared, apart from Ailsa, who merely raised an eyebrow. Symington's face had swollen, her right eye puffy and bruised. Bruce held his daughter as she hid her face in his chest. Daly leaned forwards, catching Scott's eye. His grizzled detective sergeant, his friend, looked determined, but Daly could see something behind his eyes, a flash of fear, something he'd never associated with the man he'd come to rely on. Almost imperceptibly, Scott nodded to him. It was time they tried something. Daly's response was equally subtle. A shake of the head only those watching very closely could possibly register. The huge screen was now completely unfurled. Members of the family and staff alike recoiled as the man in the cloak walked past them, awaiting the blow that would send them into oblivion. Having reached the screen, the man in the cloak stopped. An image flickered into life, illuminating the large dark room. He pointed at the screen. Everyone in the ballroom at Cursive House watched as a picture began to form. Chapter 43. Neither Dunn nor Jock could see the man in the shadows.
"Stay exactly where you are," he said gruffly. "Put the weapon on the ground."
Slowly Dunn leaned down and placed the machine gun on the floor.
"Now, put your hands on your head and turn around, both of you."
Jock and Dunn did as they were told. They heard footsteps as the man walked towards them and retrieved the weapon.
"You can turn back round now, but no funny business, mind."
"Percy,"
said Dunn, shocked to see the old caretaker hefting the weapon awkwardly on his shoulder.
"I would have thought you'd have known better than to be involved with this shit, Jock," said Percy.
"And just what do you mean by that?" asked the big man, struggling to keep his voice low.
"What have the Shannons done to you?"
"Nothing, not directly, anyway," said Jock.
"So why are you part of this plot?"
"What do you mean?"
asked Dunn.
"I know everyone's imprisoned in the ballroom, including your boyfriend with a gut," declared Percy. "You must be in on it, otherwise you'd be up there with the rest of them. What did they give you to betray your own folk, Jock? Money?"
"You've always been a stupid bugger, Percy. Put the gun down and listen to what I've got to say."
"And have you and this bitch overpower me? Not lightly. She knows these marital arts, you know. She nearly broke my bloody wrist earlier on."
"You mean martial arts?"
"Whatever they're called, she's a bloody danger as well as being a temptress. Has that big oaf that's meant to be in charge by the balls. I hope you haven't fallen for her charms, Jock. You're too old for that shit."
"We've escaped. We're trying to get to the village to get help," said Dunn.
"And the band played Believe It If You Like. Do you think I came down in the last shower? I've seen some things in this house over the years, but these goings-on take the biscuit. I hope you haven't harmed Mrs. Shannon. You'll pay if you have," he said, his voice suddenly raised.
"You've been a faithful retainer all these years, Percy," said Jock.
"And what's that supposed to mean?"
"Och, I've always known who you really are. Now, put the gun down."
Dunn looked on in amazement as the caretaker lowered the weapon and shrugged his shoulders.
"You're wrong. Whatever you think is wrong."
"What does it matter now?" replied Jock. "We've more important issues to consider, I think you'll agree. The people up in that ballroom are in real danger, including your precious Ailsa Shannon. You have to help us."
"I will," said Percy, "but on one condition."
"Which is?"
"Just you keep your suspicions to yourself."
Dunn, now thoroughly confused, was about to ask what they were talking about when a distant crack echoed down the stairwell.
"What was that?"
asked Percy, concern etched on his face.
"A gunshot," replied Jock.
For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. The words were emblazoned across the huge screen.
"This must stop now. What do you think you're doing?" shouted Daly, getting to his feet. A security guard marched over to him and forced him back into his chair with the butt of his weapon.
"Sit down, there's a good chap. Everyone shut up and watch the man," he shouted.
An image of an emaciated child, swaddled in a dirty blanket, filled the screens. Flies swarmed around the child's mouth, nose and eyes, which stared out of a gaunt skeletal face. In the background, a woman sobbed as an exhausted doctor in a white coat shook his head. The picture faded, to be replaced with stark black writing on a white screen. As a direct result of corporate actions taken by Shannon International in the developing world, more than 20,000 children have lost their lives. The next display was different. A nameless UK high street, late at night. In a doorway sat a bearded man covered by an old sleeping bag. He patted a little dog by his side, its coat patchy where great sores had taken hold. The man looked at the camera, the desperate plea behind his eyes easy to discern. Again the image faded. Over 8,000 people have been made effectively homeless in the UK alone after being evicted from Shannon International properties or having loans and mortgages foreclosed by banks and other lending institutions controlled by the company. Now they saw an aerial shot of the ocean. Amidst the blue and green of the waves, a brown slick spread into the distance. Hundreds of fish lay dead on the surface, their silver bodies bobbing amidst the oil. A seabird, its plumage a black gloss, was dying, poisoned while trying to clean itself and fly away. It flapped its heavy wings in vain. The shot panned to a huge tanker. Brown filth spilled from the scuppers as the crew flushed out unwanted fuel. Though the flag was one of convenience, the word Shannon, emblazoned along the side of the vessel, displayed the real inconvenient truth. Vessels, industrial plants and factories owned by Shannon International across the globe pump thousands of tons of toxic chemicals into our skies and seas every day, as though it is their right to destroy our world. A teenage girl stood on a dimly lit street corner. Her blonde hair straggled down her back as the camera drew level with her. As she turned to face the lens, she pulled down her skimpy red top to reveal tiny breasts, like pimples on her skinny ribcage. She stuck her tongue into the corner of her mouth as she gestured with her hand. As a direct result of economic activity by Shannon International, hundreds of thousands worldwide find themselves in poverty, forced into crime and prostitution in order to survive. The wrinkled face of the woman spoke of old age and exhaustion. She sat on rough grass outside a hut in a shanty town. Around her, dogs barked, barefoot children played in the red dust, and others went about their business. This woman has yet to celebrate her 50th birthday. On average, employees of Shannon International in Africa have a life expectancy of 51.
"Enough!"
roared Ailsa, getting to her feet, her face reflecting the glow of the screens. She stood her ground as the screen went blank, and the cloaked figure walked slowly towards her.
"We can use this side exit," whispered Percy. "I'm the only bugger who knows it's here, I dare say."
"Isn't it locked?" asked Jock.
"Yes, of course it is. I've made sure every door has been secured, what with all this shit going on in the last few days." "Congratulations," said Dunn. "Doesn't appear to have worked, though, does it?"
"Never mind that," said Jock. "How do you propose we get through? We can't break it down. The noise would attract attention."
"I'm not that wandered," replied Percy indignantly. "Might like the odd dram now and again, but my mind's all there. Here's the keys."
He pulled a huge bunch from his pocket, each bearing a small wooden tag.
"Now, where is the bastard? I can hardly see in this light."
"Come on, man," pleaded Jock.
They were at the end of a corridor, and the only way forwards was through the old oak door. As Percy continued to fumble with the set of keys and mutter under his breath, Dunn held out her hand.
"I think this is it,"
said Percy, trying to fit the old mortise key into the lock with shaking hands.
"Please, we need to hurry,"
said Dunn.
Got it.
Aye, but we'll have to get out of here quick. They're all over the place. Jock stopped.
Percy was leaning against the door, clutching his chest.
I have a pain, he said in a weak voice,
as the door slid open, and he fell out into the pale moonlight.
Dunn leaned over him. Percy? Percy, try to keep calm.
Jock bent down stiffly.
Can you hear me, Percy? Listen, we have to try to get to the village and get help. You understand, don't you? We have to save everybody. We have to save Ailsa.
Percy's voice was barely a whisper.
Do what you have to, Jock, he said,
his thin fingers clutching the big man's sleeve.
Save her, please. She's all I've got left of...
I will. We have to go.
Jock tried to stand, but Percy, with the last of his strength, grasped his arm more tightly.
Promise not to tell anyone about us, Jock. My name...
I promise, Lachie. You have my word.
Percy looked up at Jock, tears welling in his eyes.
I should have kept her safe. I've let her down,
he whispered, as the light left his eyes. Dunn straddled the old man and breathed air into his mouth, then started the rhythmic pumping of his chest as she had been trained. Jock stared down and placed his big hand on her shoulder.
Come on, lassie. He was an old man. All this excitement was too much for him. But he had had a good innings. We have to go. If we get into the shadows, we might have a chance.
Reluctantly, Dunn stood up, drawing the small radio from her pocket. The security guards, confident she had been subdued, hadn't bothered to remove it.
DC Dunn to all stations receiving. I'm okay and have managed to leave the building. The old man, Percy, is dead. His heart gave out. I couldn't save him. I am going for help. Over.
She stared at the device, hoping that someone had heard what she had to say, even though she knew they wouldn't be able to reply. The pair hurried away, leaving Percy's body behind. His blue eyes stared across the land that had once been his home.
Chapter 44
Bruce got up and stood in the way of the cloaked figure as he made his way to Ailsa, still standing boldly at the end of the long table. A security guard stepped forwards, ready to pull Bruce back into his seat. But the man raised his hand, the folds of his cloak falling loosely over his bare arm.
"She's my mother, you bastard! Lay one finger on her, and I'll kill you. I don't know how, but I will!"
At Bruce's side, his daughter Nadia also stood, her chin jutting out bravely.
"She's my grandmother. Don't dare harm her," she said through her sobs.
The man in the cloak paused for a split second, then slowly removed his hood.
"I know who she is," said Brady in his New York drawl. "And now you know who I am."
Despite himself, Bruce stepped backwards, gripping the table to remain upright. Gasps around the room were soon replaced by cries of bewilderment. By revealing his identity, Brady had shifted the emotion in the large room. The fear of the unknown was becoming contempt for the familiar. As though sensing this, Brady swung round, his handgun raised.
"Who would like to be first?" he said,
a large smile plastered across his face.
"Linton? Or what about you, Maxwell? Yes, I think I'd like you to be with me at this difficult time."
He nodded to a security guard, who pulled the cowering Maxwell from his chair at the other end of the room and marched him towards Brady. Maxwell was visibly shaking as he was deposited in a chair in front of Brady, who pressed his gun tight against the back of Maxwell's head.
"Now, let's play a little game. Who wants to save Maxie's life? Any takers?"
Maxwell snivelled. Keeping his head still, he looked around the table, wide eyes staring.
"Ah, come on, don't be shy, guys. This is your new chairman, the guy you look up to. Can nobody think of anything that will save him?"
He paused for a moment, waiting for a reply.
"Nothing, eh? I want to ask you a question before I blow your brains out, Maxie. I had a nice little plan brewing. Scupper the associate companies, cause some panic, then get you elected as chairman."
He leaned his head into Maxwell's.
"But you were ahead of me, weren't you?"
"I don't know what you mean," replied Maxwell in a quivering voice.
"The Chinese and Russian mineral deals falling through. Do you think I'm stupid? I know you've set up a shadow company to take over the contracts."
He gestured round the table with the handgun.
"You saw the misery your family has caused, is causing around the world. Aren't you ashamed? Aren't all of you ashamed? You sit in the lap of luxury, not lifting a finger, while people die, while the planet dies around you, all because you were born with the name Shannon, or married one," he said, looking pointedly at Ailsa.
"I promise," whimpered Maxwell. "I didn't have anything to do with the mineral deals falling through, nothing at all."
"You lying bastard,"
shouted Brady, forcing the gun into his head.
"He's not lying."
Ailsa's voice was calm and clear.
"I'm responsible for that." "What an executive board! All your schemes and plans! What a parcel of rogues! You're by far the most impressive, Charles. But you've paid a heavy price, too, haven't you?"
"Meaning?"
"Your daughter, Veronica."
Daly was taking everything in, looking round the room for any chance to seize control of the situation. In his earbud he heard Dunn's voice, and had to stop himself from crying out with relief. One of the security team caught his eye and patted his machine gun. Daly stared back, showing no emotion. It was as though a huge weight had been lifted from his shoulders now that he knew she was safe. Despite the scene playing out in front of him, despite nearly dying on the ratstone, despite it all, he knew one thing was true. He loved Mary and wanted to be with her. Daly saw Scott lean forwards and widen his eyes, as if trying to draw his attention to something. He followed his DS's eyeline, and spotted one of the guards lighting a cigarette, his weapon hanging loosely by its webbing strap at his side. He moved his head a fraction, to show Scott he understood. Daly coughed. Then Scott fell backwards in his chair. The guard dropped his cigarette and fumbled with his gun. He was too slow, though. Daly dived from his chair, catching the man in a rugby tackle, as he watched Scott roll back to his feet with the fluidity of a gymnast. He, too, dived at the security guard, and the pair wrestled the weapon out of his hands. It had taken split seconds to disarm the guard. Daly heard screams as those in the room realized what was happening and rushed from their places around the table. In the ensuing chaos, he twisted round with the gun and brought down an onrushing security man with a short burst of automatic fire, which caught him in the arm. He turned quickly again, keeping low, as another charged towards him. Between them, Scott was still wrestling with the first guard. Despite the risk of hitting his friend, Daly raised the weapon ready to fire. The man knew he was beaten and held up his hands by way of submission. Scott quickly stripped him of his weapons as Symington did the same to the guard Daly had shot down. Daly looked round. They had gained the upper hand, but it had been too easy. Something wasn't right. He looked across at Brady, and could see that he was equally unnerved. People had rushed for the large doors, but a bottleneck was forming, as though unable to leave the room for some reason. Amidst the fleeing bodies, Symington appeared at his side, her right eye now almost closed where she had been pistol-whipped earlier.
"Brady has Ailsa and her party at the end of the room. We have to consolidate," she shouted, as the screams of those unable to get out of the ballroom at Cursivay House grew louder.
Daly saw Brady, his cloak now stained with blood, with two security guards holding a small group of people hostage at the far end of the room, among them Ailsa, Bruce, Maxwell and Nadia, as well as Inspector Aitchison and the constable from the support unit. Brady spotted Daly and called out,
"Stop what you're doing or I kill them all!"
The guard at his side fired a long burst of ammunition into the ceiling, bringing a terrified hush on the room. Daly was about to speak when Symington stood and walked towards the table. Though she was slight, her back was straight and her head high as she spoke to Brady.
"We seem to have reached an impasse. "Why don't you give this up? You're going nowhere from here. My officers are armed."
"You think you have the advantage? I have the cream of the crop here, the top Shannon elite, not to mention two of your men. You surrender, or they die one by one."
Ailsa stepped forwards.
"Why are you doing this, Charles? In the years I've known you, haven't we always got on well? You've even been on my side. I admire you."
"Isn't all the misery this family has caused reason enough? Don't you have any shame?"
"I'm not a Shannon, remember?"
"Oh, that's right. I should have thought more about that. Let me tell you an interesting little tale," he said,
holding up his hand when he saw the old woman was about to interrupt.
"No, trust me, you'll want to hear this, Ailsa."
"What now?" whispered Scott, now at Daly's side. "And how the hell can nobody get out of here? Something's no right, Jimmy."
Ignatius Moore stood behind the huge doors of the ballroom. He'd managed to place the thick metal bar between the handles just before the screaming and gunfire had started. He was breathing heavily and, despite the cold of the night, could feel perspiration running down his nose. He hated being in this house, hated being anywhere near the Shannon family. Each time he saw a member of the family, he felt anew every one of the hundreds of lashes he'd had to endure over the years. They'd taken him from the orphanage, where he'd been deposited as a little boy, and sailed him across the world to be a slave on one of the huge farms Shannon Agricultural owned in the Northern Territory. He often wondered how many other children had suffered the same fate, taken from the UK to a strange land to be battered and cowed until they were broken by brutal sheep farmers who cared more about their animals than the children under their care. He had loved his adoptive mother, though. He remembered seeing her for the last time, her face swollen and bruised, where his father had battered her. He told the doctors she'd been in a road traffic accident. Whether they believed it or not made little difference. It was the 70s in the Northern Territory, where men were men and their word was their word. Moore had managed to escape, to build a new life, some months before. She hadn't. He'd made it to her bedside just in time. As he held her hand, the old woman whispered to him,
"I love you, son."
She held on for a few more hours, but spoke no more. He saw to her funeral, which his adoptive father did not attend. Despite his better judgment, and even though he was free of the man who had brutalized him for so long, he made his way back to the farmhouse one final time. The old man was in the yard. He'd grown deaf over the years, but he was still fit, a life on the farm leaving his shoulders broad and his forearms thick. He was bent over a piece of machinery, as the boy he had beaten throughout his childhood crept up behind him, and hit him over and over again with a heavy shovel. Then Moore walked back into the hell that had once been his home and looked at the bureau. Property of Shannon Agricultural, Australia, Limited. He removed the tiny brass plate before setting fire to the old piece of furniture, and then walked up to a nearby rise to watch the property blaze. He'd thrown what was left of the man he called his father into the house as the flames began to lick at the sides of the white wooden building. Now, Moore pulled the brass plate from his pocket. He'd carried it everywhere with him since that day, and it felt familiar in his hand as he rubbed it for the last time. He remembered the face of his wife, too young and too beautiful to die, and flung the brass plate on the ground. Picking up the first jerry can, he sloshed petrol down the long corridor outside the ballroom. Daly watched Brady. He couldn't be sure he hadn't played a direct role in any part of the horror he had faced at the Rat Stone, but for some reason he doubted it. Brady seemed too focused, too determined to be part of the insane cult. Yet here he was in robes, clearly at the heart of whatever was being perpetrated against the Shannons.
"I want you all to listen," shouted Brady. "I was brought up in rural Ireland,
Our life there was quiet. We lived on a small farm on the west coast. Big skies, green hills, rain. Hey, it was Ireland, right? He chuckled mirthlessly. But I remember, every night I would wake up, my heart beating in my chest. I could never work out why. One summer, oh, I'd have been about 12 years old, a man came to call. He was old, a big man with broad shoulders and huge hands. He took me away from my folks to his cottage up in the hills. We fished, we hunted, we talked. He told me how he'd been watching over me for a long time, how he had plans for me. I was clever at school, and he wanted me to be cleverer. Brady walked slowly down the room. Behind him, the guns of the remaining security guards were trained on Daly, Scott, and Symington, who returned the compliment with the weapons they had recovered. When I finished up in the village school, he came back. My folks packed my bags and said goodbye. I went with the big guy. First to Boston, where I went to high school, then to New York. I was a clever kid, and he encouraged me to be the best at everything I did. I ended up at Harvard. And the rest, you know. Well, most of it. Daly was listening carefully when he smelled something, a sharp, pungent smell. He turned towards the main group, still huddled around the door, now convinced he was smelling petrol. Quietly, he tried to attract Scott's attention as Brady carried on with his story. To cut a long story short, the old man was dying. He was over 90. He asked me to go to his house. I was working on Wall Street at the time, still wet between the ears, but I knew who he was. I couldn't believe it when I walked into that room. There was my boss from the trading floor, an old college professor, the CEO of one of the biggest banks in the city, even a senator. That was the night I became one of the Brotherhood. That's when I became a member of the Society of the Golden Bough.
A druid! Well, well, such a surprise, said Ailsa.
It's taken me a long way. I don't concern myself with all that sacrifice bullshit. That's in place as the opium of the stupid, the foot soldiers. Keeps them working hard, fighting for the cause.
The cause? To kill, maim, and commit all manner of perversion? Shouted Symington. Your followers nearly killed DCI Daly. We know what they've been responsible for in the last few days. There's nothing noble or glamorous about a collection of deranged sadists.
There's nothing noble or glamorous about a company that kills and maims thousands, ruins our planet and everything that lives in it, motivated by pure greed. Someone needs to hold the corporate world to account. Someone needs to champion our world. It has been our duty, our privilege, for millennia.
And leaping about in cloaks, killing people in the most cruel and degrading way possible, is championing the planet? I never had you down for a psychopath, Charles, said Ailsa, the disgust plain in her voice.
There are many things that even you don't know about me, Mrs. Shannon, replied Brady, with a smile.
Chapter 45 Dunn scrabbled and slipped through the drifts, trying to stay off the cleared pathway, which was slick beneath a fresh layer of snow. She'd already fallen and grazed both knees. They ached as she pushed on, her chest burning as she gasped for breath in the cold air. She'd left Jock behind. Despite being fit for his years, he couldn't keep up. He had urged her to push on to the first cottage, where its occupant, Tom Fletcher, would raise the village in order to save the Shannons. As Dunn struggled on, she realized that she didn't give a damn about the rich family or their cliff-top mansion. She was doing it for one person only, Jim Daly. She'd nearly lost him to the Ratstone. She wasn't ever going to let that happen again. She repeated this to herself, whimpering, as she forced herself to push onwards as fast as she could. Up ahead she saw a tiny light. She lengthened her stride and hurried towards the flickering candle flame.
"I need to talk to you," shouted Daly, interrupting Brady's story. "You do, Mr. Daly. Be my guest. We've got all night." "Well, some of us have," he said, looking at his captives. "If you intend to set fire to the house,
I'll have to stop you. You realize that? Who mentioned burning down the house? I've got a much better plan than that. Can't you smell the petrol, Brady?
He sniffed the air and shrugged his shoulders.
Sure, I can smell it. What do you intend to do about it?
I'll tell you what. Fix the problem, if there is one, and you can have Nadia.
Don't fix it or fuck me about, and you can have her back with a throat cut. You got me?
Daly looked at Scott.
One wrong move. Aim for him, Brian, he said, making sure Brady could hear.
As far as I know, there's only one way down from here, and it's through those doors.
Do you think the bastard's at it, Jimmy? Asked Scott. Who else would be trying to torch the place? Oh, and if you're not back in 20 minutes...
Brady looked at Nadia and raised his gun to her temple.
Daly took his machine gun and elbowed his way through the crowd of people. The closer he got to the huge doors, the stronger the smell of petrol became. He tugged at the large brass handle, but the doors wouldn't budge.
Is this the only way out?
After a mumble amongst what remained of the Shannon AGM, an old woman spoke.
The only alternative is via the balcony terrace. There's a service path that was used to string lights along the front of the building. But you'd need a harness. In this weather, you would never keep your feet. It's only about 6 inches wide, tight up against the wall.
Daly tried the doors again. He considered trying to break them down with fire from his machine gun, almost instantly dismissing the idea for fear he ignited the fuel.
If you make it to the far end of the service pathway, there's a window with a catch on the outside of the frame. I used to watch Percy laying the light cables along it when I was a boy. From there you can access the corridor, said another man, who looked like he could have been Bruce Shannon in another 20 years. It's a suicide mission, said another woman. In this cold, in the dark, it's impossible.
Time's ticking on, Daly, shouted Brady.
He forced his way back to Scott's side. The doors are stuck fast, barricaded in some way. The only way past is along a service pathway on the outer wall of the building.
Brady spoke before Daly could finish.
Be my guest. One way or another, I have no intention of being fried. Certainly not in this company.
He pointed to the French windows that led onto the balcony terrace. Moore had learned as a young man to do things properly or not at all. If he completed any task less than perfectly, he would be punished with a beating. As he wound his way down the long corridor with the third can of petrol, he knew that there was no escape for the family he despised. He pictured their death throes in the flames that would engulf them and their precious home. Die in the fire or jump. It had a symmetry that pleased him. He reached into his pocket for the big brass lighter that had once belonged to his wife. He'd borrowed it to light candles in the kirk during the power outage. He knew that the Shannons and their captors were now imprisoned in the ballroom, victims of their own security measures. In the 90s, the old doors had been strengthened with steel plates. The ballroom was like a massive panic room where the family could gather to wait for help. But he would make sure help was out of reach. To ensure success, he'd disabled the sprinkler system, controlled from a panel in the caretaker's office in the basement. He wasn't sure if it would have worked, considering the power cut, but with the emergency generator still running, he didn't want to take the risk. Old Percy had been so keen to show him all around the house. He felt a pang of guilt about deceiving the old man. After all, he had wasted his life at the beck and call of the family. Moore had stepped over his lifeless body on the way into the mansion. The Shannon's demise would be recompense, not just for the horrors he'd experienced as a child, not just for the death of his troubled wife, but for the thousands of others who had suffered at their hands. He thought of his adoptive mother. Her frail attempts to protect him from the beatings, all was in vain. He could see her smiling face, battered and bruised, trying to make him feel better as she tended the wounds on his back with cotton wool and the disinfectant that stung him so. He remembered the day the boss had come to call. He'd arrived in a big truck, the name Shannon Agricultural, showing proudly on the side through a layer of red dust.
Is the boy any good?
asked the man, who, if anything, looked even rougher and more unkind than the man he was forced to call father.
"Ah, you know, mate, needs a kick up the arse every day to keep him right."
"Here, let me save you the job today."
The stranger chased him around the truck, then administered a kick to the young Ignatius Moore's stomach. He could still feel the pain as he curled up in the dirt, the two men laughing at his agony.
"That'll teach the little bastard."
Eventually the man drove off. Shannon Agricultural. Moore flicked his thumb across the wheel of the lighter. Daly was on the terrace. With his torch he could make out the service pathway, no more than a ledge, now covered with snow. About 30 feet along it he could see a long window, with a catch showing proud of its frame. Along the wall were iron brackets, no doubt in place to string the harness and the lights he'd been told about. He looked down. Under the jut of the big balcony he could make out the lower floors, then nothing save the cliff and the luminous crash of the waves far below. His chest tightened. He had no head for heights. He walked back into the ballroom. At one end were Brady and his captives, at the other Scott and Symington. He had his machine gun levelled at Brady, with his guards and the captive policeman, while Symington had hers pointed at the guards they had disarmed. The rest of the Shannon party were still crowded around the door.
"I'll have to go for it. There's a ledge along the front of the building that leads to a window. I can't see another way. If the fuel is ignited, we'll all have to jump for it, and trust me, that isn't a pleasant prospect. Either way..."
"Did you see anything? I mean, any sight of someone through the windows, Jimmy?"
said Scott, keeping his eyes trained on Brady.
"Nothing."
"Could it no just be some kind of leak or something? They've been using petrol generators."
"No, it's coming from behind the door. We have to be quick."
"I'll do it,"
said Symington.
"What?"
asked Daly and Scott in unison.
"I'll climb along this pathway. It makes sense."
"How so?" said Scott. "I'm no into throwing wee lasses off the side of tall buildings. I'll have to do it. Begging your pardon, ma'am."
"Are you a climber, dear Scott?"
"No, I've climbed out of a few scrapes in my time, but no what you'd call actually real climbing. Something wrong with folk that do that, if you ask me. I'll give it a try, though."
"I'll go, and that's final," said Daly.
"May I remind you, gentlemen, of the command structure here? You're not built for it, DCI Daly, and DS Scott shakes like a leaf most of the time. I'm a climber. It's one of my hobbies. I'm doing it. End of discussion."
She walked forwards, the bruise on her face a horrible dark colour in the light of the ballroom.
"I warn you, Mr. Brady, my officers have orders to shoot you dead if they think any harm is about to come to any of your hostages. I'm going to stop us getting burned to death, do you understand?"
"Good luck," said Brady. "You'll need it."
"You seem very calm, if you don't mind me saying. You'll burn with the rest of us."
"I have faith, and my faith can move mountains," he said with a smile. "I'd get moving if I were you."
Moore cursed the lighter as he threw it down the passageway. No spark came from the flywheel when he had tried to ignite the flame. The flint was exhausted. He tried the doors, all of which seemed to be locked. Then he remembered, as he'd slipped in the back door over Percy's body, he'd noticed a candle burning on a tall table. It was two floors below. He ran to the spiral staircase and began winding his way down to the lower floors of the building. Soon the Shannons and their magnificent mansion on the clifftop would be cinders, and his soul would be at rest. Superintendent Carrie Symington looked over the stone wall that protected the side of the balcony terrace. Sure enough, she could make out a little step onto a narrow ledge that ran all the way to the window, its catch protruding in the light of her torch. At about head height, iron bars jutted a few inches out from the wall. These had once been used to string lights along the wall, but would serve as decent handholds. Her bare hands were already stiffening in the bitter cold, but she stepped up and over the thick stone parapet and tentatively placed her foot on the ledge.
"Be careful, ma'am," said Daly.
He was standing with his back to the parapet, holding a torch in one hand and his weapon in the other. He glanced at his superintendent, and then back in through the French windows to Brady, still inside the ballroom with his captives. He could see Scott from the corner of his eye, his gun trained on the erstwhile Shannon finance director.
"Has she fallen yet?"
Brady shouted from inside the ballroom. Symington slid her foot along, pushing the snow from the ledge. It was difficult, but in a way it helped her. The snow had insulated the surface of the ledge from forming ice, so once she slid it from the next section, she could glide forwards, her body flat against the cold stone of Cursabay House. Daly looked down as the white snow displaced from the ledge tumbled into the darkness. There was one thing he now knew about his boss. She had guts. Moore reached the bottom of the long spiral staircase, his knees aching with the effort. He turned left and headed down the passageway that led to the rear of the house. The corridors became narrower here, less well decorated, the carpeting thin and utilitarian in the places intended for the family's lackeys. He leapt down a short flight of stone steps and into the small vestibule at the back door. Sure enough, the large candle was still flickering in its sconce on the table. Carefully, he pulled it free of the holder. At one point, the flame flickered alarmingly, forcing him to stop in his tracks until it steadied. Old houses were filled with draughts. He would have to be careful. Slowly, he made his way along the passageway, up the short set of steps, and along a narrow corridor. He turned a corner, and there before him, at the very end of the passage, he could see the first curl of the spiral staircase. He walked forwards as quickly as he dared.